right. Speaking of sickness, we have sickness in the beginning of our parasha.
Which portion
would that be? You, out of here. Okay.
No,
we all have the good teeth. Okay, Parshas Vayichi, last Parsha in Sefer Bereishis, in the first of the five books, the book of Bereishis, the final Parsha on page 268 and 269, is the beginning of the Parsha. We pick up the story of Yosef and his brothers. We have gone through in the last couple of weeks in which Yosef has revealed himself to his brothers, cleared up the last 22 years of history since they had been separated. Yosef moves the entire family down to Egypt, Yaakov and the remaining wives and children, everybody who was up in the land of Canaan, in the land of Israel, as we have it today, was moved down to Mitzrayim, the land of Egypt. They meet Paro, they have the brothers meet Paro, Yaakov meets Paro, and they settle in the land of Goshen. Our story begins, we're going to begin chapter 48. We'll learn a couple of verses, a couple of psukim in the beginning of Perek Mem Ches. But the beginning, you'll notice there are a few verses before that. The beginning of the parasha opens with Yaakov requesting from Yosef not to be buried in Mitzrayim, that when the time comes for him to die, he requests, in fact demands, makes Yosef swear to the fact that he will not bury him in the land of Egypt, but will return his remains to the land of Israel, be buried in the cave, the Ma'arasa Machpelah, where Abraham and Sarah were buried, and Yitzchak and Rivka were buried, and Yaakov was to be buried with his wife Leah as well. And that is the beginning of the parasha. Then we'll get into what we're going to study, in which Yaakov gets sick, and he gives blessings to all of his children, and eventually the parasha concludes with his blessings to his children. He dies, the brothers all go up to the land of Canaan to bury him, and then the Torah concludes, this Sefer Bereishis concludes with the death of the brothers, and the beginning of the servitude of the Jews in the land of Egypt. But Let's start with the beginning of chapter 48. So the Torah says as follows, Vayhi achrei hadvarim ha'eile. It was after these things, after the things which we just discussed, the opening paragraph of the parsha in which Yaakov had demanded of Yosef not to be buried in the land of Egypt. After these things, Vayomer li Yosef, it was said to Yosef, it was told to Yosef, Hinei avicha chole. Your father has become ill. Remember, the Jews and Yaakov lived in the land of Goshen, which was a suburb of the main metropolis of Egypt where Yosef lived with his family. He was the second in command of the entire nation, so he lived in the big city. The Jews were off to the side. They were shepherds, so the Egyptians used to worship the sheep, so the Egyptians did not want the Jews in their midst, and Yosef knew that, and Yosef therefore placed them off to the side where they could do their thing and not be bothered by the rest of the Egyptian society. They could be a little bit protected and insulated. So it was told to Yosef, got to come home to the land of Goshen, your father has taken ill. Vayikach es shenei vanov imos, he took his two sons with him, es Menashe v'es Ephraim. His two sons, Menashe, his older son, and Ephraim, his younger son, and Yosef takes them to get brachas. Rashi explains, why did he take them? Rashi, to be blessed. Yosef wanted his two children to be blessed by Yaakov before Yaakov dies, and therefore he goes to take him. Now in this verse, the Gemara in Bava Metzia says a fascinating thing. The Gemara says, on the phrase, Hine avicha chole, your father has taken ill, the Gemara says, Ad Yaakov, until Yaakov Avinu, loy have cholsha. There is no such thing as illness in the world. Illness didn't exist. Yaakov was the first to take ill. Boy Rachma, he prayed and requested such a concept, such an illness, and he took ill. And the sages derive from this verse, this is the first instance of sickness that we have. Now, the commentators of the Talmud already point out this is not the first instance where a person is ill. We have, of course, Avram. Abraham himself is ill following his circumcision at the age of 90. But the commentators point out the first type of illness leading to death, a deathly type illness, the deterioration of the body leading to death. This is the first time in world history where you had it. Until this point, person just sort of expired, And here you had that slow, which we find natural. We find, yeah, the body deteriorates. It's a slow process. We know when a person is aging, a person is deteriorating, so to speak, from a health perspective, a physical perspective. Now, we all know, of course, it doesn't always happen that way. But Yaakov was the first one to pray and was granted that request, and he took ill. Why should Yaakov be the one to request that? What was it that Yaakov saw that Avraham didn't need and his father Yitzchak didn't apparently need and no other generation before him needed? Yaakov saw this need that it has to be, I can't just leave this world suddenly. I need to become sick. There needs to be a warning. There needs to be a period where I know that the end is coming. So I believe the answer to that lies in a verse a little bit later on in this parsha. If you will flip quickly to page 274, which is the beginning of the next chapter, chapter 49, following the incident which we are about to learn, which is the incident of the blessings to Yosef's two children of Ephraim and Manasseh. Following that incident, Yaakov, and now again remember, he's ill, he's deathly ill, Vayikra Yaakov el Banov, the beginning of the chapter, Yaakov called to his sons, Vayomer he'osfu, gather together, assemble yourselves, Vayagidu lachem es asher yikra eschem ba'achris hayamim, I will tell you what will befall in the end of days. Again he says, then gather yourselves and listen, and he goes through the blessings. This begins, you'll notice on the English side, the little headings, you'll have Reuven on the bottom of page 275, and then you see he speaks to Shimon and to Levi, and he speaks to Yehuda on page 277, and then you see Zevulun, Yisachar, Dan. He goes through blessings to each one of the 12 tribes. And they're not just blessings, if you have a chance to read through them, which is not going to be our topic for today, but he doesn't just give them a blessing that may you become this or that. He gives an insight into who they are, the nature of each one of the personalities of the 12 tribes, what they need to accomplish, what they offer the Jewish people, and what they present and represent as part of this 12-tribed, 12-pronged concept called the Jewish people. And what's interesting, and all the commentators point out, before he blesses each tribe, he says twice, Hey Osvu, gather together, Hikabtu, you know, assemble yourselves. So that he didn't just say, and what often has, you know, when I was in, I was in the hospice doing my internship, when I was in Georgia State 2 years ago, for my counseling degree, so my internship was in the hospice Atlanta. So this was a regular scene, this was something which in a hospice you see all the time. That's what a hospice is. So you'd have a procession, so to speak, in which each of the family members would, so to speak, say their goodbyes. And it would be a very private moment. Each family member would go in and have a few minutes with the patient and whatever they would do, one at a time. And Yaakov didn't do that. He doesn't call in each one of the brothers. A lot of the statements that he makes to the brothers are harsh rebuke. Reuven, for example, the firstborn, had his status of firstborn stripped from him. And it was handed over instead, the concept of the kahuna, the priesthood, was not given over to Reuven, the firstborn, it was given over to Levi, then the kohanim, and the priesthood you would eventually have. Yosef, you find, is going to be given a double portion in the land of Israel. Reuven lost his status, and Yaakov gives it to him for an incident which you learned about a couple of weeks ago, following the death, it was just a little a sidebar, following the death of Rachel, of Rachel, Yaakov's primary wife. So Yaakov moved his permanent bed into the tent of Rachel's maidservant, Bilhah. So Reuven, who was the firstborn of Leah, took offense to that. Rachel and Leah were the two sisters who should have been on par. If Rachel died, and everybody knew that Rachel was a preferred wife, that was clear, but if Rachel dies, so the permanent bed should have been moved into the tent of Leah, not into Rachel's maidservant, Bilhah. So Reuven took offense at that decision of Yaakov, and so he personally switched the beds, moving Yaakov's bed from Bilhah's tent into Leah's tent, which was entirely inappropriate for him to meddle with that, was not his business. So Yaakov, in this week's Pasha, takes him to task and says, for your impetuousness, for you're not allowed to do that. And therefore, he was stripped of his rights as the firstborn, and that was included in what we refer to as blessings, but again, not all of the blessings are all entirely just, you know, that you should become this, become that. There are statements of who you are, where your strengths are, where your weaknesses are, and he does that publicly. He doesn't call in each one of the sons individually to say, this is what you are, and this is what you need to do in life. And this is what you're about, and this is what you need to do in life. He calls all the 12 sons together, and in a moving deathbed moment in front of everybody, goes through each one of the sons and says what they're about and what they need to accomplish and contribute to the Jewish people. The reason for that, as you can intuit on your own, if everybody needs to be self-actualized and fulfill their potential and contribute to the general whole, the biggest factor that you need to know is not only what you need to do, but you need to know what everybody else has to do as well. You need to be aware of the group dynamic. Because if I think that this is what I need to be doing, but I don't know who's doing this, this, or that, and I see that it needs to be done, so maybe I'll step in and I'll try to do it. I end up stepping on your toes and you stepping on his toes. It has to be clear. It has to be that everybody knows everybody else's role. When you have that, then the group can function as a whole seamlessly, because everybody knows what everybody's doing. I know, that's not my strength, that's your strength. You're going to take care of that, I'm going to take care of this. We suffer from this horribly today in the Jewish world. We don't have that Yaakov-like figure saying, oh, well, you see, the Hasidim, they really know how to pray well. They really know how to daven with emotion. They know how to daven with feel. They're going to be in charge of, you know, daven. They're going to handle the daven. We're going to handle the learning. These people are going to handle the chesed. We don't have that. We all try to do everything. And I'm not saying that we all need to do it. We all need to daven. We all need to do chesed. We all need to learn. But they're focused. Different groups have different, better, are more equipped to do certain things. And just like in any organization, if I know that this group is handling the chesed committee and this group is handling that committee, and it works. When you don't have that, you end up with a mosh, and everybody's stepping on everybody else's toes saying, I know how to do that better, and it should be done like this, and it should be done like that. So Yaakov, when he gives his blessings to his 12 sons, specifically says, I need everybody here at the same time. Everybody's going to hear what everybody else is doing also. Reuven, I'm going to tell you, you're going to have to hear what you're going to have to hear, but you're going to hear it in front of everybody. So they know. And Shimon and Levi and so on and so forth. So all 12 were together in this picture of what Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people, were going to be like. They all heard that. Yaakov is the first one who asks for sickness before he died. Yaakov is the first one who's got these 12 sons. Avraham passed it on to Yitzchak. There's one son, Yitzchak, who is going to be the carrier of the Jewish tradition. Yitzchak passes it on to his son, Yaakov. Esav was not going to be part of this picture. But Yaakov was divided into 12. And at that generation, the passing on from what had been Avram and Yitzchak and Yaakov, and from there, the river breaks into 12 different, the prism, which had been just one unit. And now when the light shines through, you get 12 different variations of how it's going to go. 12 different peoples, 12 different customs, but all part of the Jewish people. All different focuses, all different strengths and weaknesses. Yaakov says, I need to be here. I need to be aware when this is coming to an end. And I pass on and give this final blessing. So Yaakov requests from Hashem to be granted the gift of illness, the gift of becoming sick before dying, to be able to put everybody together, gather them up and say what he needs to say. And it has always been a Jewish tradition, a Jewish concept, that illness is a blessing. You sometimes hear after these horrible tragedies in which planes are blown up or crash or other horrific tragedies, you'll hear on, you know, talk radio, people will debate, you know, is it better to go, so to speak, instantaneously, or to have a long, drawn-out sickness? They debated in the world which one, and you'll hear people hold like this and people hold like that. It's always been a Jewish approach. It's a blessing to be ill, because it's a blessing to be able to put things in order. It's a blessing to be able to speak with one's family, with one's children, with one's friends, and to, so to speak, tie everything up, leave over what you want to leave over, instruct those who you want to instruct. It's always been viewed as a blessing. And Yaakov is the one who is the first, the sages say, to have requested and been granted that blessing to be able to do that. Okay, moving on. That's all verse number one. So Yaakov gets sick. So they tell to, it's told over to Yosef. By the way, Rashi points out who told, back to page two, So again, Pasuk Aleph, verse 1, it came to pass after these things that someone told Yosef. Rashi points out, what do you mean someone told Yosef? Who's the somebody who told Yosef that his father had gotten sick? So Rashi points out this was Yosef's younger son, Ephraim. Ephraim had spent all of his years not living with Yosef, but spending his time studying with Yaakov in Goshen, so that when Yaakov, his grandfather, got sick, Ephraim came back to get his father Yosef and say, you know, grandpa's sick, you have to come, bring everybody over, get your final blessings. Okay, Pasuk Beis, verse 2, Vayageh Yaakov, it was told then to Yaakov, he vayomer hine bincho Yosef bo eilecha, your son Yosef has come. So Yaakov is sitting on his deathbed, he's in the land of Goshen, they tell him, your son Yosef, the second in command of all of Mitzrayim, has arrived with his children. Vayischazek Yisrael, so Yaakov, who is often referred to as Yisrael, exerted himself, gained strength, vayeshev al hamita. And he sat upright on the bed. Rashi points out, Vayischazek Yisrael, that Yaakov exerted himself to gain the strength to be able to sit upright on the bed. Omar afal pi shehu bini, Yaakov said to himself, even though this is my son, and if anything he's supposed to honor me, melechu, nonetheless, he's achieved the status of a king. Va'achalek lo kavod, and therefore I bestow upon him honor, because he is, after all, a king. Mikan, and the sages say from here, from the fact that Yaakov the father, on his deathbed, gathers up all of his remaining strength to be able to sit up appropriately in front of his son, Yosef. Mikan, says Rashi, shechokin kovod lo malchus. Here you learn out, doesn't matter if it's a Jewish king or non-Jewish king, the institution of Malchus is one which commands and demands respect. There's no such thing as saying, whatever. King is respected. And the reason for that, or one of the reasons for that, I should say, is always the concept of a king is a glimpse into what it means to understand what Hashem is to us in the world. Well, what does it mean to be our king? We say our father, our king, all the time. We only understand things in the spiritual realm in the way that it manifests itself in the physical realm. That concept, we've spoken about, it exists in many, many areas of Judaism, and so we use the physical to understand what it means to have its corollary in the spiritual. And the concept of a king teaches us what it means to have a ruler, a person who's in charge, can do whatever they want, you're subservient to them, and it gives us an insight, a starting point, as to how to be able to appreciate what that is. And the sages learn, therefore, you're obligated to be mechalik, to give out appropriate honor to a king, regardless of the situation, even if it's your son, and it doesn't have to be a Jewish king. You're required to give respect to the malchus. Now, I point this out because this is at the heart of a fascinating issue at the end of the parasha as well. As the story is going to go on throughout the parasha, so Yosef gets sick, Yosef brings his children, and then Yaakov blesses all of the children, and then Yaakov eventually dies, and the whole family goes up to Canaan to bury Yaakov, and then they come back. And when they come back, so the brothers run into trouble again. The brothers are quite afraid and disturbed that Yosef, if you remember, whom they had sold, this is now 40 years earlier, because they were separated for 22 years after the sale, and then Yaakov lives for 17 years in Mitzrayim before dying. So this is now 39 years after they sold him. So Yosef was sold at an age of 17. We're now 39 years later, so he's 56 years old, and he was the second youngest brother, so they're all older than that. And they are afraid that Yosef is now going to take it out on them for what they've done now that Yaakov has died. That until Yaakov had died and he was still alive, Yosef wasn't going to do anything to them, because after all, Yaakov is still here. And now that Yaakov has died, they become rather frightful. So much so, they change the truth, Rashi points out, because the Torah says that they, if you want to flip to the bottom of page 286, this is at the very end of the parasha, the last couple of verses. We'll read from 15. On the bottom of page 286 and 287, Pasuk Tesva, Vayiru ache Yosef kimeis avihem, the brothers of Yosef saw that their father had died. Vayomru lu yistemenu Yosef, they said, perhaps he will nurse a hatred against us. V'hashed yoshiv lonu eiz kol hara'a asher gomalno, so he will surely repay us for all the evil that we did to him. So they're afraid, they get back, And they're not sure what's going to happen. Vayitzavu el Yosef leimor. They instructed that Yosef be told. And this Rashi points out did not happen. They veered from the truth in order to protect themselves. Avichotzivo lefneimol. So your father gave orders before his death, they say. Tell Yosef, Ona sona pesha achecha, kindly forgive the spiteful deed of your brothers and their sin, for they have done you evil. And Yosef wept when they spoke to him. This is what they saw. This is what they were afraid of. Yosef cries. They say to him in verse 18, his brothers say, they flung themselves before him and said, we are ready to be your slaves. Yosef has to say, Hatachas Elokim, am I in place of God? This is not my business. He says, you intended to me harm. It turns out to me that it was good. I'm not interested in any retribution. I'm not in the place of God to that's not my business. You intended bad. He made it work out for the good. Stop worrying. But the brothers were concerned. Rashi points out, where did their concern come from? So Rashi says an amazing thing. The pasuk in 15, which we read in the beginning, it says, "Vayiru achei Yosef kimeis aviem." The brothers, now they translated it here as perceived that Yosef, that now that their father was dead, that he will have hatred towards them. The word that the Torah uses is not just a word that means perceived, but means "Vayiru" means they actually saw that now their father was dead, and they said he's going to come to do something to us. So Rashi says, Mavayu, what did they see? What did they see that gave them rise to be suspicious that things were going to not be so good for them? Says Rashi, Hekiru b'misoso eitzel Yosef. They saw in Yaakov's death how it affected Yosef. Shehoyu regilim l'sa'od al shulchan al shel Yosef. It used to be they were regulars at his table. They're invited all the time. Yaakov was around, the brothers would get together, they would eat, they were in the palace. V'hayim mekarvan, he would bring them close. B'shvil kavod aviv, u'mishemeis Yaakov lo karvan. And now that Yaakov had died, the invitation suddenly dried up. So they say, there's clear indication. When Pop is around, the family sticks together. Soon as Yaakov died, we haven't been invited over in a while. It's for sure because he's harboring hatred towards us. Who knows what's going to be? So Rashi quotes based on the sages. Now, did Yosef harbor the hatred towards the brothers? No, it's clear in his response to them. Absolutely, no intention. So why did he stop inviting them? How can he stop inviting them? So one of the commentators writes, brilliant, this is what he says. He says, Reuven was the firstborn. Yehuda, the fourth son, had the status of, what was he given? Kingship. A priesthood went to the third son, Levi. But the fourth son, Yehuda, has kingship. In order to be a king of the Jewish people, you have to descend from the tribe of Yehuda, as King David did and all of his descendants. When we mentioned a couple weeks ago, that's why the Chashmonaim, from the Hanukkah story, who were priests, when they completed the victory in the Hanukkah story, and they took over as the king of the Jewish people, they were punished for that. They were punished. Do we speak like this? It was some other group? I don't remember. I don't know. I'll briefly mention it. If I did it, whatever. The tapes will be. Someone can go back and listen to all the old records. The Chashmonaim, who were priests, led the battle against the Greeks in the Hanukkah story. When they took over, not only did they reinstitute the temple service, they also took over as in the monarchy, the king of the Jewish people. So the Talmud takes them to task, because it's a clear verse in this week's Parsha, when in the blessing given to Yehuda, that the kingship is never allowed to pass out of the tribe of Yehuda. And therefore, the Chashmonaim were punished so much so that the Talmud says, within 200 years of the Hanukkah story, there was not a single descendant left from the entire house of the Chashmonaim. So that anybody, any Jew, the Talmud says, who would ever claim to be descendants of the Chashmonaim of the Hanukkah story, you know that he's a slave. He's not a real Jew. He's a non-Jewish slave. Because we know there's not a single member of the family left. The entire family was decimated as a punishment for taking the kingship, which they weren't allowed to do. They were allowed to be the priests. Kingship has to stay within the tribe of Yehuda. And as a punishment for that, for taking the kingship when they weren't entitled to that, the entire family was wiped out. We don't have a single remnant. Within 200 years of the Hanukkah story, there was not a single descendant left from the Chashmonaim family of the Hanukkah story. This is one of the areas in Torah where there's a combination in Judaism. There's a combination between aristocracy and meritocracy, in that the three major branches of Jewish leadership: you have kingship, which we don't have today, but you have a king, you have the priesthood, then you have the rabbis, the head of the Beis Din, of the high court, who sets the Jewish law. You have the king who makes sure that the law is being kept, and you have the high priest who does the service, and you have the actual rabbis who are the ones when there's a halakhic question, it's brought to the rabbis and they make the decisions. So the kingship is an aristocracy. You have to be of the tribe of Yehuda. It doesn't matter how well qualified you are, how energetic you are, it doesn't matter. If you're not descended from the tribe of Judah, you can't be a king. And if you are descended and you're not qualified, you can't be a king. It's aristocratic. Priesthood is the same thing. It has to be in the family of a Kohen, descended from the tribe of Levi, and if you're not, it doesn't matter how much you know, it doesn't matter how qualified you are, you simply cannot serve in the Beis HaMikdash, you cannot be one to bring the sacrifice, you just can't. You can't even walk into certain areas. What do you do to earn it? Nothing. You were just born into a certain family. When it comes to the leaders of Torah, when it comes to the rabbis, that the Gemara says is a meritocracy. And it's open for everybody. The books are on the shelves. You want it? Open one up and study. He who achieves the greatest level of knowledge will become the leader of the Jewish people. He'll be the head of the high court. Doesn't matter who your father is. Doesn't matter who your grandfather is. Nobody asks those questions. In fact, the Talmud points out all of the converts and those who have descended from not such great lineage who have held that high seat. And that is the combination when you have the three branches of Jewish leadership, of kingship, priesthood, and Torah scholarship. Two of the three are aristocratic. In order to be a king or a priest, it's a family thing. And a son has the first rights, son of a high priest, son of a king, if they're qualified. And that is totally aristocratic. It's caused us problems over our years. But that's the way that it's set up. And it has to be. There is such a thing as a dynasty. There's a ruling family. And then there's the Torah branch, which sets the policy and answers all the questions. And that's totally a meritocracy. And more often than not descendant father to son, father to son. It's every generation. Someone comes up from the most humble of beginnings and says, well, this is what I want. And the Rambam has a beautiful language, Maimonides. He says, anyone who wants to come and take it, you can raise up the banner. And it's yours for the taking. Torah belongs to all of us. And no one can say, I'm of a certain family, I'm of a certain lineage, it's more mine than anyone else's. You can say that by kingship and priesthood, but you cannot say that by Torah. Any case, so, Yosef said, when my father was alive, there was a problem as far as the seating arrangement goes around the table. Who sits at the head of the table? So I have my older brother, Reuven, who's the firstborn, the eldest, and I have the fourth eldest brother, Yehuda, who's the king, and they're both of greater stature than I, whom brother number 11. But as long as my father is here, and my father says, Yosef, you sit at the head of the table, you're the king of Mitzrayim, no one's got any problems with that. So I did. Now my father's not here anymore. I can't sit at the head of the table. Where should I sit? I should sit myself over my older brother, Reuven, the Bechor, the firstborn of this family, and I should take precedence over Yehuda, who contains within himself kingship. I'm not allowed to do that. So I should sit in my regular seat in spot number 11. I'm not allowed to do that either, because I'm a king. I'm a king. And Yaakov, my father, who stands up for me at the head of his bed, on his deathbed, for his son, because I'm a melech. And when you deal with a melech has to be treated with respect. The king is that you have to. Yaakov stood up for me. My father stood up, and on his deathbed, I'm not allowed to sit seat number 11 in my palace. But I'm not allowed to sit in seat number 1. And if Yaakov, my father, is not here to say, no, you sit in seat number 1, leave Reuven and Yehuda, they'll stay where they are. You're the king, you sit there. I'll listen to you, Dad. But if he's not here, I can't. Where do I sit? So the commentary says, so why the invitation stop? Because Yosef had no way around the problem where to how to seat them. He wasn't allowed to sit in seat number 11. He wasn't allowed to sit in the head. So, all right, we'll do Thanksgiving separate. We'll have the Pesach Seder on our own. But the brothers just saw the lack of invitation. And so the brothers make up a story out of fear that Yosef is going to take graduation. Your father said, don't forget what he told us. It's a great lesson in so many levels. But, you know, when we have our own fears, we have our own issues, we see them in every situation. a brother who's afraid of what took place 56 years before. No, it's 39 years before. Now, and they were punished, they dealt with it already. But if you're still afraid of that retribution, so then everything that you see in your reaction with Yosef, and your interaction with him is going to be, maybe that's what it's about. Maybe that's what it's about. And you see it everywhere. When you don't see it everywhere, you're open to the possibilities. Well, maybe there's another explanation out there. Maybe he's not having us over because of, who knows what other reasons are out there. And so we're so blinded by the glasses that we wear in which we see events, and the concept of dan lekav zchus, of judging other people favorably, is such a difficult task and such an integral task of our life experiences, because wherever we want to see things, we see them. Life events are so open to interpretation, and we are so want to interpret them based on our previous experiences and the way we want them to be. That often happens. And you have a classic example of that. And it's all based on this, which Yaakov taught Yosef when Yosef approaches on Yaakov's deathbed, and Yaakov gathers the strength to sit up, and he says, "You're a king. I will treat you with due respect because you're a king, even though you're my son." So Yosef says, not even a year later, just a few weeks later after Yaakov dies, and the brothers go up and they come back down, and he says, "So now where do I sit? I can't sit at the bottom of my table. I have to sit at the top. How can I sit at the top and have my younger brothers, my older brothers, excuse me, the Bechor and the king, sitting on the side? That doesn't work either." So Yosef felt the best interpretation was to do nothing. And the other lesson we can take from here is communication. Right, communication. Right, we always assume that everyone's thinking along the same lines that we are. And that usually doesn't happen that way. The Talmud has a great line, great, great line in the Tractate Sanhedrin. The Talmud says, "Kishem shepartufeihen einen doima zu lazu," just like a person's facial features are not similar one to another. No two people on the entire planet shares facial features. "Kach deoseihen einen doima," their thought processes are not similar one to another. Brilliant insight, as Talmud says. We like to think, okay, so we look differently, but obviously everybody thinks like me, for sure, right? I mean, this is just so logical, it's just so clear that this is what needs to be done, or what should be done, or what was done. The Talmud says, look in the mirror. Just like nobody looks like you, nobody thinks like you either. You have your own hard wiring and electrical impulses which cause you to think, and your experiences which shape the way that you think and what you do. Certainly there's a range of normal thinking, and obviously that's why we have an entire field of psychological disorders in which you're outside of that realm. But to think that because you saw things like this, so obviously everybody else, says the Talmud, ain't happening. It doesn't work that way. And so that's why communication is so important. Okay.
I had a question.
Yeah.
I don't see in the Parsha where it actually tells, where Joseph tells his brothers why he was not having them over.
Right, it doesn't.
So do they ever know?
No, it's unclear. That's just one of the Rashi comments from the sages that what the brothers saw that made them suspicious is what they weren't being invited anymore. Right. One of the commentators on Rashi says, and why did he stop inviting them over? Because he had this dilemma. He wasn't sure how to seat them. But it's not clear whether or not that ever was communicated to them, other than they were... It's not clear that they ever said, this is why we're suspicious. The only thing that we have is that they said, we're afraid. Don't forget what Dad told us, not to take anything out against us. And Yosef starts crying and says, I never was planning on doing anything like that, and makes peace. But whether or not there was a communication, I don't know.
It's clear that was the reason.
No. The sages say the reason was, I mean, why he didn't have them over? No, that's, let me just clarify. Let me just clarify. Let me just clarify. What's clear is that the brothers suspected Yosef was out to get them. Mm-hmm. The sages say that was because he stopped inviting them over. Mm-hmm. So that's on this level of, that's what the sages say? Okay. One of the commentators explaining that suggests that the reason why he didn't have them over was because of his dilemma regarding the seating. That's one of the later commentators explaining the sages. So I'm glad there's a hierarchy in terms of where we could offer our own interpretations. So we could offer another interpretation why he would have them over. This is one of the interpretations offered, but that the sages were the ones who said what the brothers saw was that the invitations dried up. Yeah?
I thought it was telling that they say, your father gave orders before his death. I mean, it's obvious that there's still a schism there, because you would think they would have said, our father said thus and so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I would
and
imagine that, yeah. They're also just trying to lay the guilt on Heavy. It was your dad who said not to do this to us, but that would be my guess. But yeah, it's an interesting insight that you have there. Yeah.
Well, are they ever criticized by the sages for having lied about such a good thing?
No, I shouldn't say no. I don't know. I haven't been through everything. What I can tell you is that...
Now, what do you still hold a grudge?
He does. Well, but they thought he was.
I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, but to lie about
it. Everyone by herself. They would have told her this.
Because they did lie about
it. Families, siblings.
No, sure. Of course.
And we're not the first one.
Yeah, no. The sages just say Shina Hadavar Mipnei Hashalom. They change in the context of maintaining peace. Similar, the same language the sages use in the story of Abraham and Sarah, when Hashem comes to Abraham and says, "You're going to have a child," and Sarah says, "When my husband's old," and when Hashem repeats that conversation that he had with Sarah to Abraham, he doesn't say it as that Sarah said, "You're old." She said, "She's old." So there the sages use the same language. You see from here, you're allowed to be mishani. You have to change a little bit, mipnei hashalom, to maintain peace. It's a whole other schmooze, concept of truth. What does truth mean? You mean that Hashem, who is truth, veered off of that a little bit for the sake of peace. What is that? How do we then define the concept of truth? That's a whole other schmooze, not for today. Yeah. Any other question?
Yeah, I wanted to know... would he have been allowed to invite them over since they were in mourning for their father?
Oh, as far as that goes?
Yeah.
The actual biblical laws, meaning there's several layers of the laws of mourning. There's the biblical element of mourning, those practices that we have, taking off the shoes and certain things. Some of them are midoraisa, biblical. Some are rabbinic, and some are just custom.
Uh-huh.
So the only period of mourning that is mandated by the Torah is the first day of death and burial, when they take place simultaneously, meaning on the same day. That's the only time that the Torah mandates a period of mourning. That day of death and of burial takes place on that same day, then you're obligated to go through the practices of not sitting low on the ground. The sages enacted the week of Shiva regardless of when the death and the burial took place. The 7, and then you have the 30 and the 12 months for a parent. And then within that, some practices are rabbinically ordained, like taking off your shoes during this first week, not getting out. And some of them are just custom, which have developed over the years. But the actual only biblical concept of having to be in a state of mourning is only on that first day. The sages have added to that, which is clearly our practice today. So that wouldn't really be relevant to them after that first day. That was an interesting question. All right, let's move on. I want to share with you a great little insight. The verse that we've been working with now, verse number, was that I'm all lost, flipping all over the place over here, I'm sorry. Verse 2 said that it was told over to Yaakov that your son has come. So Vayishchazek Yisrael, so he gathered his strength, Vayeshev al hamita, and he sat up on the bed. So there's a comment made by the Baal HaTurim. The Baal HaTurim was one of the classic commentators printed in your classic edition of the Chumash. So what he does very often, his particular niche as a commentator, is he finds similar words in various places in the Torah and links them together, or he does numerical equivalency. This word is numerically equivalent to this. And he does all sorts of fancy little one-line comments on the Torah. So on this he comments, there's another word, another place not in the Chumash itself, but in Torah, where the word hamita is used. It says Yaakov Yoshev al hamita, he sat up on the bed. Mita means a bed. There's another bed, which is plays a very critical role in a critical point in a story. It has to do with Purim. Haman and a bed.
He fell
on the bed, right? When he has a second party with Esther. So he's having a big party, and Esther's there, and Esther reveals herself to Achashverosh and says, there is this evil man, Haman, he's trying to destroy my people. So the king, Achashverosh, goes out to his little porch to gather himself out of his anger. And then Megillah says, meanwhile, Haman is praying for his life, beseeching Esther. And the Haman no fail al Halmita. When Achashverosh walks back in, Haman has fallen on her bed. And Achashverosh says, Hagam l'chvosha ismalka imira. Are you trying to seduce my wife in my own palace? The sages say that a malach was, an angel was pushing Haman over, but as he's pleading for his life, he's literally tripping over himself, falling onto her bed. So the Baal HaTurim writes a fascinating insight. He says, the tzaddikim, the righteous, in their moment of demise, as Yaakov's about to expire, he's about to leave this world, he gathers strength and sits on the bed. The Rishayim, the wicked, in their greatest moment of glory, Haman, who has now been invited for the second consecutive night to dine with the king and queen by himself, in his greatest moment of glory is nofel al hamita. He's falling on the bed. So the Baal Turim just points out in that same word, hamita, the word bed is used both, and it just points out a very interesting thing, that from the righteous you see them gaining strength and rising on their bed, even in the last moments, and the wicked are falling. And it's really an insight, it's not just in their last moments, it's really an indication in the bigger picture of the world, in the spiritual realm of things, that is really what's going on. As the righteous, even though it seems physically they're being pulled down, it's the end, you really see a rising up in the reality of what they accomplished in this world. And the wicked are really at towards their end of demise, are always, I don't know, falling. And he just pointed out, I just thought that was cute, just wanted to share that. Okay, let's move on. Alright, verse Gimel, the third pasuk. Vayomer Yaakov al Yosef. So Yaakov says to Yosef, Kil Shakai Nira Eli, the name of God, one of Hashem's many names, he says, appear to me in Luz in the land of Canaan, and he blessed me. And he said to me, Vayomer Eli, Hinani Mafrecha v'hir b'sicha. So this is what Yaakov now reports to his son Yosef about what Hashem had told him many years before. So what did Hashem tell Yaakov? What was he going to bless him with? I will make you fruitful and numerous. Mafrecha v'hir b'sicha. Fruitful and numerous. Nisaticha l'kahal amim. I will make you a congregation of nations. And I will give you this land for your offspring after you. So the sages point out, Rashi mentions this, the phrase l'kahal amim, a congregation of nations, implies many more nations. Not just another nation, I'm going to make you into a congregation of nations. The time that Hashem said this to Yaakov, he already had 11 children. This prophecy that Yaakov is reporting now had taken place many years before, at a time which Yaakov already had 11 children. So he knew he was going to have one more child, but one more child would not be classified as a congregation of nations. And the blessing that Hashem is, I'm going to make you into a congregation of nations, implies many. One more child would be, you only would have used the word, I'm going to make you into another a nation or another congregation. It seems to be a pluralism of what you're going to be made into from here. Not just one more, but several more. Right? Making myself a little bit confusing, but so far, let me see if I finish the thought, if it made any sense. So Yaakov says, but I only had one more child, so I knew one of my children had to be divided into two. Because the prophecy that I got was that I was going to become a congregation of nations, but I only had one more children after that point. One more child after this point in time. So that there must be some other child of mine, which is going to be subdivided into two. And that was going to be a fulfillment of the fact that I'm going to be a several pronged congregation of nations beyond what I had had at that point already. That make sense? Yeah.
So what you're saying is because that point in time, what came before was, it didn't matter.
Right.
Okay.
Therefore, it seemed like the blessing and prophecy was you're going to be made from here on out into a congregation of nations, but I only had one more child. That wouldn't be classified as a congregation. That would just be made into another nation or another congregation. Each tribe was considered like a nation unto itself. Mm-hmm. So Yaakov at this point says, that's what I was told, and I am bestowing that blessing, Yosef, unto you. And I'm going to take your tribe and subdivide that into your two children. So your two children, Ephraim and Manasseh, are going to be elevated to the status of tribes themselves. As Yaakov himself says in verse 5, Pasuk Hey, Va'ata, and now, Shnei Vanecha Hanoladim Locha B'Eretz Mitzrayim, the two sons of yours born to you in the land of Egypt, Ad Bo'i Eilecha Mitzrayim Li Haim. Those sons born to you are to me. Ephraim and Menashe, your two sons, Ephraim and Menashe, Keruvain v'Shimon Yihiyuli. They should be like Ruvain and Shimon, like my own two firstborn children. Your two sons will have the same status as my sons. Basically, elevating the status of a grandson to the status of son. So that Yaakov, who had his own 12 sons, subdivided his 11th son, Yosef, into two. And very often, whenever the Jewish people are counted, they're always counted as 12. And depending on whether or not Levi is counted, sometimes Levi is not counted because he didn't have an actual plot in the land of Israel. So whenever Levi is not counted, then we count the two sons of Yosef as separate tribes, Ephraim and Menashe. And when we do count Levi, then we only count Yosef as one. But when we divided up the land of Israel, for example, so they're counted as two separate tribes. There's a huge dispute between Rashi and the Ramban, between Rashi and Nachmanides, exactly how this worked when Yaakov elevated their status. According to Rashi, each tribe was given the amount of land so that every member of the tribe received the same amount of land. So meaning, when we sat down and we said, Reuven, okay, how much land do you need? At least, well, I have 100,000 people. Okay, 100,000 people, each one gets, let's just say, one parcel of land. You're going to get 100,000 parcels of land. Shimon, I have 80,000 people. Okay, you get 80,000 parcels of land, and so on and so forth. So that according to Rashi, even though we created separate tribes of Ephraim and Menashe, meaning they were given separate areas of land to live in, they each had a separate flag and a separate place in the desert in which they would encamp, when it came to the actual inheritance of the land of Israel, it didn't make a difference. They would have gotten the same amount anyway, because Yosef, instead of just saying, my whole large family has 100,000 members, now we said there are two tribes, each with 50. The number of heads didn't change, just the fact they were in two separate areas. So according to Rashi, the tribe of Yosef didn't actually get more land as a result of this. They just were in two separate areas of the land of Israel, but got the same amount of actual land, because of the way that it was divided went based on the number of heads per tribe. According to the Ramban, that's not how they did it. They gave each tribe the same amount of land, and then each tribe subdivided it amongst its members. So that according to the Ramban, a large tribe, each individual member would get less land than a smaller tribe, but the tribes themselves were 12 even portions. But according to the Ramban, the fact that these two tribes were subdivided meant they got a whole lot more land because of it. That's all parenthetical. It's just those who are interested in the way the land was divided. Yeah.
So we don't know what the size of the plots were that they were...
Not exactly. Not exactly.
We have an idea of where they were.
Right. If we knew exactly, if you're asking because if we knew exactly, we'd be able to answer this question and come to the conclusion. Exactly, right.
I thought we did.
Yeah, we know exactly how much land. The maps have them, you know, the maps you could find, you know, it's basically divided up, but exactly how much it was, we don't know. So what I want to conclude with is, a few verses later, Yaakov actually gives a blessing to Ephraim and Menashe. What blessing does he give them? It's a number of different verses, but the part that I want to say is on the bottom of page 272, the blessing. Then a famous incident, this is where Yosef sets up the brother, the older son, on the right side so that Yaakov's right hand should go on the older son, and Yaakov switches his hands so that his right hand goes on the younger son, Ephraim. And we'll learn about that maybe next year, Mirtz Hashem. But the last thing that I wanted to speak out today...
Is that okay. Because he was learning with...
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we don't have to learn about it next year. Elaine knows already. Okay, at the end of the blessing, he actually says in verse 20, Vayivarchem b'yom ahu le'mor, the bottom of the page, he blessed them on that day, saying, by you, b'cha, yivarech Yisrael le'mor, the Jewish people will always bless their children with you, saying, Yisimcha Elokim ke'Ephraim u'chemenashe. The blessing that a Jew will give to his sons will always be, says Yaakov, may you be like Ephraim and Menashe. And certainly, as a Jewish people, we've developed that for girls, you give, this is what's done Friday night, before Kiddush, the father gives brachos to his sons, he says, Yisimcha Elokim ke'Ephraim u'chemenashe. His girls will say, Yisimcha Elokim ke'Sara Rivka Rachel v'Leah. But this is the source of that, that the blessing that Yaakov gave to Ephraim and Manasseh, that you will be used as the model with whom the Jewish people will bless their children for all generations. Why were Ephraim and Manasseh chosen for that task? So this has been said over many times, but it's worth saying over because it's such a beautiful idea. Because Ephraim and Manasseh were just elevated to the status of tribes. Ephraim and Manasseh were grandchildren, elevated to the status of children. And the model of success of any person is in which they say, not only did my children follow in my footsteps, you know what, that's not always a proof, because maybe I forced them into it, or I beat the living daylights out of them, or I scared them, or whatever. But if my grandchildren follow that path, so that it became so imbued and so ingrained in the children that they passed it on to their generations, then for sure, that's a model of continuity from as the Jewish people are all about. And Ephraim and Manasseh not only are grandchildren who were elevated to the status of children, they were grandchildren living in exile. They didn't grow up in the house of Yaakov. They never met Yaakov until they were already grown men. They were born in Mitzrayim. Yaakov didn't come down for many years after. Well, I shouldn't say grown men. It was only 22 years. They were older. But to be born and live in exile, not in the land of Israel, not in the house of Yaakov with all the tribes, but in a foreign land, and for Yosef to have successfully raised his children in a foreign land and still have them accomplish the same feat as being on the same spiritual level as the generation before them, as being of the tribes themselves, on that we bless our children every Friday night, and we say you should be like Ephraim and Manasseh, that even as the generations go on and we get farther and farther and farther away from our great leaders and scholars and forefathers, and we go farther and farther every generation, that we bless our children, that you should be like Ephraim and Manasseh who went against that grain, and even though the generations went down, they maintained that same spiritual level as they had been previous to that. And that is the blessing that we bestow upon the Jewish children of Ephraim and Manasseh. Those are some thoughts on Parshas Vayechi. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.